Murres, whales, auklets, and even a couple of ragfish have been found dead, washed up on beaches from California to Alaska over the past 6 or 7 months. Many appear to have starved, but a general sense of mystery surrounds the multiple deaths. What is causing thousands of seabirds and marine mammal deaths? We'll discuss what's known and what still needs to be today on Talk of Alaska.
Today's program is underwritten in part by Raven Alaska, connecting Alaskans across the state for more than 50 years. Find more at flyraven.com. At the Salmon Project, they know that Alaskan lives are salmon lives. Join them this winter as they journey across the state and hear the stories of Alaskans whose lives are amazingly similar to yours, even if they live 2,000 miles away. Learn more at salmonlife.org. This message sponsored by the Salmon Project. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Hello, welcome to Talk of Alaska. Is it El Nino, the warm water blob, or something else that is causing these alarming mass die-offs? USGS biologist John Pyatt said it's the worst die-off he's seen in 40 years. Here to discuss the latest information is Rob Kaler. Rob works in the migratory bird management with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And Dr. David Irons is retired, sort of, from FWS. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for being here. Let's start, before I launch into a bunch of questions, I also want to let our listeners know there has certainly been a great deal of interest in what's happening both in Alaska and up and down the Pacific Northwest coast. So please call in if you have sightings that you want to discuss, if you have questions that you'd like to call in and ask the biologists who are with us today. The number is 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK. If you're calling in the Anchorage area, it's 550-8422, 550-8422, and you can email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. So let's start with just a little bit of your background and why you guys are here talking with us today. Dr. Irons, tell us about the work that you've done and how it relates to this seabird research that's going on right now.
Well, I came to Alaska in 1976 and actually worked on sea otters out in the Aleutian Islands for 5 years. And then I started working on seabirds in 1980. And been working throughout Alaska on seabirds in the Bering Sea, in the Gulf of Alaska, Prince William Sound, for the last 35 years. And so of course, the Exxon Valdez oil spill hit Prince William Sound and the Northern Gulf, and that created a lot of excitement and concern. And I was out working in Prince William Sound in 1984 before the oil spill, and because the oil spill hit, we have been doing work there ever since.
Mm-hmm. And so you tried to retire, but sort of got dragged back into work. Is it because of the situation with the die-offs, or why is it that you were called kind of back into service?
Well, it was kind of happenstance. I happened to be down Whittier inspecting my friend's boat. I saw all these white blobs on the beach, and I wasn't sure what they were. I thought there were too many to be MERS, and so my family and I went down and started counting them and came up with a lot of dead MERS on the beach at Whittier. You know, so.
Had you ever seen, you've been studying seabirds since 1980, almost 36 years. Have you seen anything like that before this time?
No, nothing.
What were your initial thoughts?
Well, as you say, this has been going on for a long time, and it was going on while I was still an employee of the service. And so, you know, I knew it was going on. In fact, I was down in Whittier a month before that, and I walked half that beach and found 3 dead MERS. And so this is very different. And there had been a 3-day storm blowing into that beach. And so a lot of MERS that were out in Prince William Sound got blown up on that beach. And so.
So could you tell how long they had been dead? Does it seem like they had been out at sea for quite a while, and then the storm just blew them in?
Well, if they're not scavenged in wintertime, with near freezing temperatures, the body's staying in pretty good shape, and they all look, most of them are pretty fresh and unscavenged, and so it's hard to tell exactly how long they've been dead, but oftentimes when this happens, they get scavenged quickly on the beach, but the numbers were so great, and the scavengers were overwhelmed, so there hadn't been much scavenging going on, but it looked like, by the distribution on the beach, that they were relatively new on the beach, you know. Hmm.
Rob Kaler, I want to get you in here now. When did the reported deaths of seabirds, MERS, and others, and other marine mammals start to become significant numbers? When did you really start to think, this is quite unusual?
Well, it was March 2015. We actually had a dog walker down in Seward walking along Resurrection Bay, and she had observed some white birds. I think it was about three. And so we were able to coordinate with the Alaska Sea Life Center, some of the folks down there, and got those birds and actually sent them off to the National Wildlife Health Center in Madison, Wisconsin for testing. It's not uncommon to find, dead birds washed up on the beach, but of course we want to, keep an eye on it. But these reports continued, and I should add that most of these mortality events with seabirds are observed in the winter. And so when you start seeing this in kind of the early spring, we thought that was interesting. And so, but we continued to get reports of MERS mostly washing up on beaches. And that continued and kind of leveled out, but it was fairly widespread across the Gulf of Alaska. I should say that the northern part of Prince William Sound, and there was kind of an uptick in birds. So one of our partners that we collaborate and coordinate with is the Coastal Observation and Seabird Survey Team, and that's out of University of Washington. But they started doing long-term citizen science work monitoring beaches in 2006 here in Alaska. And so those provide kind of a background baseline value of what's normal for seeing seabirds washed up on the beach. And those surveys going on through the summer started giving us a signal, kind of a tick in the middle of the summer. And so that's unusual. As well as some of the colonies that are being monitored, these common MERS are ledge nesting birds, nest in very large colony ledges, and those are some of these long term sites that have been monitored by the Alaska Maritime National Wildlife Refuge actually abandoned their breeding attempts in the middle of the season. So that's common MERS are kind of our stalwart seabird. They generally get about 50% off reproductive success per year, and so for them to give up breeding was very unusual, and for the Gulf of Alaska had never been reported, and these data have been collected at some of these sites since the late 70s. So that was reason for concern, and of course this was ongoing. On top of, in 2014, we saw above average sea surface temperatures in the North Pacific. Those temperatures continued into the summer of 2015, above average sea surface temperatures, and that's when I think the warm body of water got the moniker the blob, the warm blob of water. And so those are they were record setting above average sea surface temperatures, and that's more of the work from the oceanographers, but we found that to be interesting, of course. And then with this El Nino event that was predicted, NOAA's Climate Prediction Center started saying, well, this appears to be on trajectory to be one of our top three El Nino events. You know, it's on trajectory to be quite significant.
Right.
And those have come to become quite true. And now it's predicted to remain strong into the late spring. So, but a real big uptick was in November. We had a report from a waterfowl hunter who was hunting out of Whittier into Passage Canal, and he contacted somebody at the United States Department of Agriculture was actually able to collect four carcasses, but they had reported seeing hundreds of birds dead and dying on the water, and this was in Passage Canal outside of Whittier, so we were able to get those four carcasses and sent them off to the National Wildlife Health Center. And they came back as emaciated, zero content in their stomach or gastrointestinal tracts. And so And then all the tests for disease, avian influenza, West Nile virus came back negative. So, so all things pointing to this starvation, essentially. These birds, for some reason, weren't able to be finding the food that they needed.
Have you been able to determine if that's what it is, that they couldn't find the food, or is it possible that something else was going on and they just weren't seeking food because lack of appetite?
That's a great question. So then we started getting reports of stranded birds in inland Alaska, you know, so from the Kenai Peninsula northward. So we got reports in Wasilla and Palmer, you know, those could be wind assisted during storm events, but they also may be seeking foraging places. And really, we should say that during the winter, this time of year, MERS should be out over the continental shelf foraging out there. So seeing them in the Prince William Sound is uncommon. I mean, but has, you know, these observations in the past often coincide with El Nino events. And so, so we were surprised, but it's not uncommon. It's unusual, I guess I should say. But so finding these birds further up into the Cook Inlet and then appearing to be stranded, and we started getting reports around the middle of November of birds at people's houses, residential homes, trails and highways, and that was pretty unusual. But in the past, I mean, there have been inland strandings, but the numbers then really kind of start increasing into December. So,
if you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska, and today we have migratory bird biologist Rob Kaler and also Dr. David Irons, who is also a bird biologist with the Fish and Wildlife Service. We're discussing the mass die-offs that have been observed not only in Alaska, but all the way down to California. There's been reportings of die-offs of different birds. There were 8 whales found dead near Kodiak Island last spring. If you'd like to join our conversation, if you have questions or you have sightings that you'd like to discuss, you can join us at 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK, or in the Anchorage area, 550-8422, 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. Kyle is in Kodiak. Hello, Kyle.
Hi. Thanks for the program. Interesting discussion. Certainly a concern. I know it's probably a minor impact, but I've been subsistence fishing in Alaska for 30, 40 years now, and this year is the first year that I've caught a significant number of common mirrors. I never caught any mirrors before, but this year I must have caught about 20, and the other boats around me, I know, were doing the same. But we were pulling them out. I was able to salvage one and let it go, but the others, you didn't see them coming in. I just discovered them as I hauled the net in and saw a great number of birds in my net. And so I thought I'd just add that. We let them, I just discarded them into the water, and I'm sure that they washed up on the beaches and may have caused some concerns. And if I was experiencing that and others were around me, I'm guessing that over a period of time that may have added to the numbers. And that's all I have.
Kyle, can you give us an idea of how many that you found?
I think during my summer subsistence activities, as many as 20 total.
And you said others were the numbers as great in other nets that you saw?
Yeah, it seemed to be. One fellow came over and he had several in the back of his boat, and he wanted to know if I was interested in taking them home. And I know anybody that would be interested in using them for subsistence purposes. I told them that I didn't know anybody. I could think of a couple of maybe friends of mine that I just wasn't able to get a hold of them fast enough to keep them from spoiling or anything.
And my last question, and I don't want to put you on the spot, but did you contact anyone to report what you found?
I did not. I was actually a little hesitant to report because I didn't know if there was some legal issues or who knows what.
Okay, well, let's clear that up and find out from our experts here. We've got two Fish and Wildlife Service biologists in the room. They're pointing to each other. Rob, I'm going to put you on the spot now. What should people do when they see these sightings? And what are the legal obligations that folks have? Are there any?
Well, that's a good question. Anecdotally, we have received reports from gillnet fishermen and subsistence fishermen that they had higher than usual catch of MERS, and so it's good to report this just so that we understand, and that'll help inform the background levels that we are seeing on the beach. The legal requirements. It's a good question. I guess I think reporting it would probably be the easiest way, but we know that these are accidental takes. So I think the best thing we can do now is just be informed about it. I'm not.
So it's unlikely that someone would be cited somehow if they called up and said, "Hey, I've got 20 dead MERS in my fishing net."
No, I don't believe so. But
okay. It's more important to get the information to scientists so they.
Yeah, and we understand that it's not a deliberate take.
Sure.
Even the commercial fisheries, of course, have incidental take as well, and we try, the larger vessels have observers on board to help document that, so in terms of being able. And it's, while it's anecdotal, it's informative just to know that a fellow who's been fishing subsistence over, 30 years, sees a spike. And even talking to some folks who go out fishing and Homer said, well, they had to fight cormorants off of their bait. They actually had to pick up the hook and move to a new location. And so really interesting to hear these reports over the summer of sounds like pretty hungry fish pretty hungry seabirds out there.
Mm-hmm. When you and I were talking earlier, Rob, you mentioned that you'd had somewhere between 50 and 60 calls, maybe more by now, from concerned citizens. What were the questions? What did people want to know, or what were you hearing in these calls?
Yeah, by now I think we've received probably 100 reports. And so, there was an uptick in our, we have a hotline at Migratory Bird Management, and there was a surge in calls over the holiday break from Christmas and then really spiking right before the New Year's weekend. And a lot of those were of concerned Alaskans finding birds in their yards. And a lot of that coming from the Matanuska Sioux Sitna Valley, the Matsu Valley. And many people just wanted to know what to do. Some of them, had seen the Anchorage Dispatch News or the Alaska Dispatch News article. Just wanted to report their observations. And what we're doing now is collecting all of those reports into a seabird mortality database. This database allows us to, track the magnitude, how many birds, the geographic extent, how widely this is occurring, as well as the duration, how long is this going on for? And then, of course, being able to kind of look at weather systems, and seeing significant spikes in mortalities as well as stranded birds inland. So I was receiving reports from snow machiners, cross-country skiers who had been finding, hundreds and if not thousands, some of these reports of birds stranded inland on frozen rivers, lakes, and ponds, as well as just out in open fields. So all of that is really helpful for us to be able to capture just how big this event is.
Well, here's an observation that came in by email. Remember that you can send us comments at talk@alaskapublic.org. And here's a listener that said, we live at the top of the Yetna River on the southern border of Denali. There are hundreds of dead MERS up and down the river and in the swamps. I'll forward that email to you when we get done with the program, because I know you want to aggregate all these things. Let's go back to the phones and hear from Matthew in Sitka. Hi, Matthew.
Oh, hi. Thank you for taking the call. So I'm a commercial fisherman, but I fish with hook and line. I haven't caught any MERS on my gear, but we do the Christmas bird count here in Sitka every year, and this year is January 3rd, and I've been doing it for a dozen or more years. I live off the road system in Sitka on one of the barrier islands, and so I normally do the bird count in the water in my skiff around my island and go over to Eastern Channel. And this year, we saw hundreds, personally, of live mirrors, but there were thousands there. They just continued on in the deep water in Eastern Channel, and I've been doing this for a dozen years, and I've never seen that many common mirrors here before. We have the ones out in the deep water, in the water there is about 75 fathoms deep. It's a deep channel that comes into from Sitka Sound into the Sitka area and back into Silver Bay. The mirrors disappeared, continued mirrors into Silver Bay. We had a report from another bird counter that saw lots and lots of mirrors in Silver Bay. And what was interesting to me, besides the amount of mirrors that we saw, were that we saw a couple of mirrors off further in the islands, off by themselves, and they didn't seem to be doing so well. The ones in the deeper water seemed to be lively and normal, except, you know, I've never seen them there in January before, like in those numbers. I have a report from another fisherman in Yakutat who saw the same thing. They saw dead mirrors, some, and listless mirrors up in further up in Yakutat Bay and in Mani Bay, but out off the reef in deeper water, they saw thousands of mirrors that seemed to be feeding and doing fine. I don't know if this is a change in migratory patterns or a change in winter residency or something. It seems like the birds that are getting in closer to the beach are not finding feed or something. This is a speculation on my part. And the ones out in deeper water are doing better. I just thought I'd pass that on.
Thank you, Matthew. Thanks so much for the call. This is what we need, is to get more information so that you can make good scientific decisions. What kind of condition were the carcasses that were reported, that you've examined, that have been turned in? What describe what their condition was or is when you're picking them up?
They're anywhere from 200 to 300 grams below their average weight. We call it subcutaneous. Essentially, the fat on their chest is non-existent, you know, and that's one of the things that gets them through the winter. Usually, it's just the right amount of fat. You don't want too much, but you don't want too little. And so these are all, you know, that's kind of their physical. So based on the necropsies that the National Wildlife Health Center did, you know, you can feel the chest bone, and it's really apparent. And from that, you can tell that this bird is malnourished or at least emaciated. And then the further tests and examination showed that they had nothing in their stomach and that there was nothing in their gastrointestinal tracts. Now, MERS actually digest food very rapidly. And so some of the concern would be that maybe there's something that they've eaten that they've now has affected them, and so it's prohibiting them from continuing to feeding. So things like paralytic shellfish poisoning, you know, at least in humans, and there's some studies for other animals as well, but in humans, you know, you get sick pretty quickly. And so whether it would stop these birds from eating to the point that they now just rely on their body reserves and then succumb to the elements during a storm because they don't have enough reserves, based on that, you know, so we continue to test these birds for things like the saxitoxin, which is the dinoflagellate associated with PSP, paralytic shellfish poisoning.
Well, let's continue on with that line of discussion. Bob is in Valdez and has a comment about PSP. Hi, Bob.
Hi, good morning. Interesting conversation. Thanks for being on, you guys. Yeah, you know, I happened to be at a family gathering in Washington, actually Oregon, last summer, and ran into a short-tailed relative, an in-law, who by the name of LaFay, and she's a marine biologist in Northwest Washington. She's been doing studies. She says she's been getting, as she put it, she says people have been mailing her whale poop from all over Alaska. She's been doing studies on paralytic shellfish poisoning, various species, but her focus on whales had resulted in findings of the highest levels of domoic acid in these whale guts. These are both whales that they found stranded and dead, or that had been hunted, and they had actually gotten the hunters to collect samples. So she said both in the live samples and in the samples from whale carcasses, she was finding the highest levels that anybody had ever recorded. And it does make me wonder if maybe this doesn't have something to do with the food supply for these MERS. Is the food supply succumbing to PSP at levels that have been unprecedented levels? I just don't know what the answer is on that. I'm not a biologist. As far as the MERS here in Valdez, there's been a few found up in the port. I haven't seen any myself. I've heard anecdotal evidence of it though here as well as. But not like the degree that's being experienced down in Whittier. But anyway, I was wondering if you guys could draw any parallels between what's being found in these whale guts and maybe some of the critters farther down the food chain. Thanks.
Thank you, Bob, for the call. And I know that you work with birds, but what are your colleagues saying? Have you had discussions about particularly the whale deaths that were around Kodiak Island?
This has been reported as an unusual mortality event for marine mammals. And I'm not sure what level that is triggered at, but there have been a lot of marine mammals, whales washed up on the beaches. And one of the things, testing of these birds, if you don't have anything in the gastrointestinal tract, it's really hard to actually do any tests for these other dinoflagellates and things, the PSP and the domitic acid for harmful algal blooms. So, it's something that, that's why we're working with the National Wildlife Health Center as well. But we also have collaborators with NOAA who are testing krill, the euphausids, and trying to determine, is that what's happening in this food web right now? So.
You can join our conversation if you'd like to. The number statewide is 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-TALK. You can also call us in the Anchorage area, 550-8422, 550-8422, or talk@alaskapublic.org if you have questions or comments about the die-offs of seabirds and other marine-dwelling creatures. Alex is in Anchorage. Hi, Alex.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. Do you have a question?
First of all, I'd like to just say that all these different patterns of bird die-offs and marine mammals is heartbreaking, and hopefully it's not a precursor to some mass die-offs. I'm thinking more on common sense that if we have such warm waters, I guess my question is if the MERS, what they feed on out on the continental shelf, if those fish or whatever they eat have dove to depths with cooler water and more food, if that would probably be one of the major contributing factors to these die-offs with the MERS.
All right. Well, that sounds like a good and reasonable question. Your thoughts from either one of you, either Dr. Irons or Mr. Kaler, are the fish going deep because of the warm water and maybe the MERS can't get to them?
Well, we know that the fish have a very narrow band of water temperature in which they live. And capelin is a good example. Capelin need cold water. And when the Gulf of Alaska is cold, there's lots of capelin here. And when it warms, they're gone. Now, are they going deep? We don't have evidence of that. They may be, but there's no evidence. People don't harvest capelin in Alaska, so there's not good data on capelin populations. But the birds eat them, and like I say, we know they're not around when it's warm. And so whether their fish are going deep or dying or leaving there in general, we don't have good data on that. And the fisheries people don't have good data on that.
All right, we are going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll have more on this discussion today about mass die-offs of seabirds and other marine creatures, marine mammals, and others as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from GCI, an Alaska-born and raised company connecting Alaskans from the Aleutian to the Arctic, from the North Slope to Southeast, and to the rest of the world. With more than 2,000 employees statewide, a proud supporter of Alaska Public Media.
It's as easy as 1, 2, 3. 1, file your 2016 PFD application today. 2, receive a confirmation of filing. And 3, sign electronically with your secure My Alaska account. Visit pfd.alaska.gov for more information. And remember, the deadline to apply is Thursday, March 31st. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We're going to go back to the phones for a moment before we get to other questions that I have. Clary is in Palmer. Hello, Clary.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. Did you have a question?
Yeah. So I was out in off of the Tulitna, like north of Trapper Creek, about a week ago, and my husband and I ran across at least a dozen mirrors, and they were kind of, they were on the snow. They would have been really easy to get. They were like panting, and they look flustered, if birds can look flustered, if that makes any sense. But so my question is, what do we do? I mean, should we, like, because I was wondering if we should just approach them, get them, and try to do something for them, or do we just leave them there? I mean, what, like, from a practical standpoint, what do we do when we find them alive?
Great question. Thank you.
We're asking that people of the public just leave the birds be. I mean, handling them and putting them in a box is going to add a lot of stress to them. And so what we're suggesting is that people let nature take its course, which sounds very callous, but when a group like our, the rehab folks at Bird Treatment and Learning Center, Bird TLC, I mean, they're just completely overwhelmed as it was. And so, as I said, it sounds callous, but these die-offs are natural events. And what we're just trying to do is encourage folks to report those sightings to us so we can keep it documented. Again, trying to capture the magnitude and duration of this, but suggesting that folks just let nature take its course.
There have been a number of email questions that have come in the last few minutes. Here's one from Mike in Talkeetna. Hundreds of murres have been found on the Susitna River and as far north as Healy. Now they're finding them in the woods, stranded. They have been bringing them back to the river so they have a chance to take off. Last sighting was just over a week ago. Now they are mostly finding carcasses. And there's several other comments that we'll get to. But talk a little bit about the difficulty for murres once they do end up on land. That they're not a land-dwelling bird, so how much tougher does it make things for them to try to forage and to even to fly?
Yeah, well, by design, their legs are pretty far back on their bodies. They're designed for flying through the water. Essentially, they're a pursuit diving seabird. And so once they are stranded on land, they're not able to get that speed up like they would be able to as they ran across the surface of the water to get lift. You know, their wings are relatively small given their large body size. And so once they're stranded on land, it's nearly impossible for them to get that speed to get lift and to take off. So, some of these birds, as they're being blown inland or foraging, searching for areas to forage, may actually be hitting trees or running into buildings and therefore getting grounded at that point. But as we've heard, you know, there's reports of birds being observed on these inland rivers, frozen rivers. There's actually reports on the Alaska Bird Listserv of observations of a flock of about 12 birds that would fly up. I think it was the Susitna, had found an open patch in the Susitna River and would dive in and was presumed forage on whatever they could as they floated down in the current. So very unusual sighting.
We have had, I have had several emails and comments from people who are greatly concerned about Fukushima, that are convinced that a lot of what's happening in the ocean is a result of radiation coming from Fukushima. Here is an email from someone in Ward Cove asking, have the whales or birds been tested for radiation? I know there is the blob, El Nino, radiation from Japan. What about the red tides and plankton populations? We've noticed a difference in Southeast Alaska. Let's talk first about what's known about what's happening with the Fukushima plant and what's being done about testing the waters. What is the latest information that's out there on this? Is this something that you are involved in or not so much?
No, we don't have Geiger counters on the beaches, but perhaps that might, you know, set people at, you know, comfort people that these are not dying from radiation poisoning. But so I can't really address that issue, but why it would be impacting one particular group of birds and not all marine life in that way. I mean, so in terms of radiation poisoning from Fukushima, I guess it I don't think it's, you know, we're seeing starvation birds foraging inland. So now, whether there's some kind of profound influence on the food web that radiation is affecting. But we're not seeing it, you know, cascading through all the other trophic levels. So, I'm not a radiation expert or that familiar with how they're monitoring the waters coming out from Fukushima.
There was also a question from a listener who is concerned, convinced that the reason that the waters have been warming is also related to radiation, that the radioactive material is heating up the Pacific waters, and that's why we're seeing these mortality events with seabirds, also linking it to the problems that have been seen in polar bears, lesions on the skin, and also in some seals. So there is a lot of concern out there. I know that the last time we reported on any testing that had been done, there was no evidence along the U.S. coast that there was significant amounts of radiation, but it appears to be hard for people to believe that or take that in because there is a lot of concern about what's happening with this plant. Let's. I want to give out the numbers one more time, and then let's go back to some questions. If you're wishing to join our conversation or you have sightings or questions to discuss with our biologist today, please call 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-8255 or 1-800-478-TALK. In Anchorage, it's 550-8422, 550-8422, or you can email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. The MERS that were found inland, did their carcasses look at all different from the birds that had washed up on the beach, or is it primarily everything that you're seeing is related to starvation?
Yeah, everything. So we've been working with the Bird Treatment and Learning Center. When some of those birds succumb or when they receive them, they may have a broken wing or a leg so they euthanize them. So we've been collecting those birds and the idea to do that is to get some demographics on these birds, be able to do the necropsies and establish what age class they are as well as what sex they are. And that'll help us get an idea of, you know, what birds are succumbing to starvation. As I previously said, all of these birds are at least 200 grams under their average weight and sometimes 400 grams. I think something in terms of the life history of these MERS, you know, they require about 10 to 30% of their body mass to be consumed per day, which is about, can be as many as 300 fish per day. And so if they go without eating for 5-6 days, that's a significant amount of weight loss that they're enduring and starvation, you know. So, their metabolic rate is high enough that if they don't eat frequently enough, they're succumbing to starvation. And one of the other ideas that is speculation, but that perhaps these warmer water temperatures are actually affecting the distribution of their food as well as their abundance. But furthermore, perhaps even the behavior of that food, you know, if they're not, if the forage fish aren't schooling and dense enough schools, then it's, the MERS are not able to forage efficiently enough to meet those daily metabolic needs.
My brother just recently retired from about 40 years of, nearly 40 years of commercial fishing in Southeast Alaska. And over the last couple of years, he told me that he had drifted through areas in Southeast where occasionally at times he called them dead zones where you would see absolutely nothing in the water. But he said in the last couple of years, he saw more of areas that looked that way and for longer periods of time. Have you had reports of maybe talking to your colleagues that are working in the marine setting about areas where there's just nothing in the water and this might be part of what's happening here? It's maybe an aggregate of warming conditions, other things that are going on, and some of these areas that just seem to have no viability or any life in them. Have you had any reports of that type of situation?
No. Alaska has a pretty amazing fishery here, and NOAA actively monitors and manages that fishery. If you're referring to perhaps like the dead zones that have been reported from the lower 48, to my knowledge, no.
Now, this was in Southeast Alaska.
Right, yeah.
We haven't really, these areas.
I can't say I've heard any reports like that. And really, you know, a lot of our work takes place in the northern Gulf of Alaska, Prince William Sound. But in terms of, we haven't seen anything like that, at least in those areas. But
In California, a year or two ago, they had a die-off of Casson's auklets down there. And in California, what happens sometimes is they live off the upwelling, and the upwelling brings up nutrients and so on. And when the upwelling stops for one reason or another, then I've heard in California that it's more like a dead zone. Where there's no prey in the water and so on. You know, and in the Bering Sea, we've had coccolithophore blooms, which is a invertebrate that creates a big, huge cloud in the water. It can be seen from the satellites, and there's so huge an area that birds in those areas can't find food. But that's kind of a different kind of thing, you know. It's a known bloom of a invertebrate.
Rob, I think you said earlier that this is a natural event. Is that what you said?
There are records in the past of, I mean, it's the name, I think, that seabird researchers use. It's a mer wreck. And so there are reports. There's several published papers on the topic in Alaska of mer mortality events like this.
And describe some of those for us. Give us some of the history about the size and scope compared to what we're seeing currently, because it's, I think it's really hard for people to see this as just a natural event.
I think it's even harder to count that natural event. But they're often correlated with years of strong El Nino. And so if you look back over the last strong El Ninos, 1993 was a strong El Nino, and there was a paper published by John Pyatt with the USGS describing, we counted this many birds and we did some statistical methodology that we were able to kind of extrapolate that out. So we counted this many, and we think that this many were actually affected. And their number was about 120,000 that they estimated had died off. I believe they had counted a little over 3,000. And that event was in the Gulf of Alaska. There's also another published paper actually from the early 70s, and that was a report from the Alaska Peninsula down at Unimak Island. And so, of course, we're getting a lot more savvy with our abilities to use mathematics to estimate what you actually observe and what that observation might actually be representing. But that's very difficult to do, especially in a place like Prince William Sound, where there's over 4,000 miles of coastline. So compared to the coast of California, Washington, Oregon, you know, we have a very convoluted and rocky coastline. So, but yeah, as I was saying, that El Nino events are often associated with these mer die-offs, mer wrecks. 1993, the 1997, 1998 El Nino also had some die-offs.
Interesting.
And so yeah, and so we are concerned because this appears to be unusual, both in its duration. We started getting reports in March. Additionally, some of the MERS actually abandoned their breeding attempts. That's, and in many places in the Gulf of Alaska, has never been recorded. And additionally, that this El Nino event is predicted to continue to remain strong and into the late spring. And so, and I think, as I said previously, that usually you see these die-offs in the winter, and we're seeing it now kind of at the beginning of, you know, of the winter period. And so we are anticipating this to continue on. And so we try not to use words like unprecedented, but this does seem to be quite unusual, both in duration and magnitude. You know, Dr. Irons counting 8,000 mer carcasses on a beach in Whittier was more than Dr. Pyatt and his colleagues counted for the 1993. So
All total.
Okay. Right.
They counted, that was one event.
Right. And if you talk with your statisticians, they might say, well, 3 to 4 days of strong easterly gales, we don't know where those birds came from, but we know they all ended up on the beach in Whittier. But as we go out to survey other areas and try to see, well, does, you know, another beach with an east-facing exposure, does it have 8,000 birds on it, you know? Mm-hmm. And that helps us gauge exactly how, you know, how extreme this event may be.
We've had a lot of good calls, but the lines are open now. Operators are standing by. If you'd like to call in and offer any more observations, sightings, questions that you may have, our number is 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK, and in Anchorage, 550-8422, 550-8422. Sean is a naturalist. He sends us an email and says, I work as a naturalist in Gustavus and Glacier Bay. We started seeing huge numbers of MERS in the bay starting in July. We usually see dozens, and we were seeing thousands. I've been here 15 years and have never seen anything like it. He says, I walked about 14 miles of shoreline 2 weeks ago, counted dead MERS, which was fewer than I expected based on what we've been seeing. He didn't list a number. My question is this, why just MERS? And that was a question I wanted to get to, too. Why not other seabirds? Why are they so vulnerable?
David just keeps pointing over at me. I'm not sure why I brought him. Just kidding. Yeah, well, that's a great question. You know, we've tested nearly 100 carcasses at the National Wildlife Health Center. The majority of those were MERS. So there are other birds being found on the beaches. Out in the Aleutians, we've had reports of auklets. But by and large, common MERS are our most abundant seabird species in Alaskan waters. The population estimate for Alaska is 2.8 million. And that's quite a number. But it is a good question. Why aren't we seeing the same impacts on other seabirds in Alaskan waters? And so it brings up some of the things I mentioned earlier with regard to perhaps they're not being able to efficiently forage. You know, these warmer temperatures, for some reason, MERS specifically are having difficulty to locate their food or find enough of their food to keep their, you know, and it's also a large bird, so their metabolic rate is high, and so getting enough of food through the winter can be a challenge. They don't forage well in darkness. In fact, I don't think they're reported to forage at dark. So these winter periods where you've got, you know, less light,
sure,
photo period, that's also affecting their how well they forage, and then as well as the storms, you know, that also is another factor. One other thing I think to consider, and this would also have broader implications for other marine organisms, is that these warm waters, when you get that mixing of warm and cold waters, that's where you get the upwelling.
Mm-hmm.
And in that upwelling is a lot of the nutrients, the phytoplankton, the zooplankton, and that, of course, is food for the whole food web. and you get layering, stratification in that water column, and so you're not getting that nutrient punch of nutrients into the system. So, but it's a good question. Why are MERS, and why is there a historic pattern of MERS being the most impacted or affected?
We will continue this conversation about MER die-offs and other concerns about the marine environment as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly.
Alaska Pacific University delivers a distinctive education grounded in real-world experience. Through their engaging staff and faculty, APU's education is designed to broaden and deepen their students' potential through action and understanding. Hashtag, this is our classroom. This message sponsored by APU.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. David Irons, you were making a point during the break here about one of the reasons why it may be MERS that we see so many in these die-offs as opposed to other seabirds. Please make that point again.
Well, the point is that in the summertime, we have, you know, probably 50 million breeding seabirds in Alaska of over 30 species. And in the wintertime, the Arctic tern flies all the way to Antarctica. And so the Arctic tern is not in Alaska and doesn't have to find food here. And many of the seabirds that breed here leave the Gulf of Alaska. Unlike the MERS stay. And another thing about the MER being as large as it is, and it's a, as Rob said earlier, it's a pursuit forager. It swims with its wings underwater. So it's really at a disadvantage for flying in the air and in the water. So it's very good at flying underwater. It's not so good at flying in the air. So for a MER to fly 500 miles to a new area to find food is much more difficult than for a gull or an albatross or a tern to do that.
Okay, so they're using a lot more energy to get to those places. Mm-hmm. Let's go back to the phones for a moment. Roberta is in Homer. Hi, Roberta.
Hi. So as you know, we've had thousands of MER deaths and sea star deaths also. And I'm going to go off on something a little odd, but in the Gulf of Alaska this summer, we had the Navy doing the war games and sonic testing, and we had the dead whales happen after that. But is there any way that, and it wouldn't account for the whole statewide, but that at that depth that MERS could have had ear damage and that could account for their erratic behavior? And then the other thing is ocean acidification. Is there anything that could be complicating that? But we also had hundreds of dead sea stars, so that's my thought.
All right. Thank you, Roberta, for that question. Any evidence that seismic testing, military maneuvers, or acidification might be impacting MERS?
I know of no studies that have demonstrated that. For as far as their hearing on the bird, but it's an interesting idea, and it's something that, to my knowledge, has never been looked at. Ocean acidification, that's affecting a wide range of animals, you know, mostly the calcareous invertebrates that can't form their shells, and so the ocean acidification may, if it was going to affect the MER die-off, it would probably be a prey thing rather than the MERS themselves.
All right, let's go back to the phones quickly. Andrew is in Unalaska. Hi, Andrew.
Hello. How are you doing today?
Good. Please give us a question quickly. We only have a couple minutes left.
I guess it was not too much questions here, but you can kind of see the weather patterns going out west. A lot of strange stuff. Usually it's pretty typical of being strange out here, but blowing west to east, you wonder how many of these birds have been blown into the mainland. I know it's hard to kind of track them. And also, I just wondered if, you know, canvassing the fishing fleet, you know, they're going to be your first responders on the ground, if you will. They're probably going to have a lot more information than NOAA would have any day. So I know it's kind of hard to talk to them, but don't worry, they won't bite, and they probably do have some good information. All right, thank you very much.
Thanks, Andrew.
We'll get your number, Andrew, and we'll get in touch with these folks. But you're right, they're the ones with the boots on the ground, as you say, and they're on the forefront. So yeah, and that's what, you know, this is a great opportunity. We're really glad to be on this show to help us get that broad, cast our net broadly in terms of being able to communicate with the folks that are seeing this firsthand.
Well, we only do have a minute or so left. What is next? What's happening currently, and what's next with the research, and what will you be doing going forward?
Well, as I've mentioned, our primary objective right now is to be able to document the magnitude, the geographic scope, and the overall duration of this die-off, coming up with a meaningful number in which we'd be able to compare if climate change is going to make these El Niños and create warm water blobs that stick around for prolonged periods. You know, this is our opportunity to quantify, you know, what are the impacts on common MERS. And MERS in Alaska, we use these as an indicator for the overall health of the ecosystem. And so at Fish and Wildlife, it's one of our indicator species. And as we move forward, trying to identify, we know that they're starving. What we want to know is, what is that mechanism causing that starvation? So two pieces, essentially, documenting this event and then understanding why this event is going on. What are the factors playing into it? Is it just the perfect storm of bad things for MERS, just a terrible time to be a MER? You've got warm water, an El Nino event. And if storms are intensifying, then pushing these birds that are already kind of towing the metabolic line over that edge. So, but collaborating with the state, with folks at the U.S. Geological Survey, both at the National Wildlife Health Center and the Alaska Science Center, and actually getting reports from folks that are seeing this on the ground. So that includes out in the villages. And working with, as I mentioned earlier, the Coastal Observation and Seabird Survey Team, that's really important and valuable information. So helping get that out, and with regard to suggesting that volunteers contact Coast, start looking at your beaches and help us document how widespread this is, as well as the magnitude. So from the agency perspective, we're going to try to quantify the overall mortality. From the public outreach, helping us is the best that we can ask for. And so,
all right. Well, thank you so much. We'll have more information on our website. I was going to have you give a number out, but we'll put that on the website. We'll also pass along these numbers and a wide range of emails that we've had to you for response. Thank you to my guests, Rob Kaler and David Irons. Thanks to Dave Waldron, our engineer, and Josh Edge on phones. I'm Lori Townsend. We'll be back next week.
Member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence. Artists make us think and question. They excite and engage. Artists inspire Alaska. The 2016 Rasmussen Foundation Individual Artist Awards Grant Program is now accepting applications. Individual Artist Awards support Alaska artists in 10 creative disciplines at all career stages. The program is open to Alaska residents only. For details and to apply, visit rasmussen.org/IAA. The deadline is March 1st, 2016. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.